Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, authors need publishers, and clearly good publishers are worth their weight, quite literally in gold. And we're delighted to actually welcome somebody who's got publishing experience and connected with all sorts of things, and also will be sharing in the sheer joy of not just one, but two Ontario authors who are winners in a prestigious international writers' contest. We're delighted to welcome to the program today, John Goodwin. How are you, John?
I'm doing very good, and thank you very much for having me on your show, Alex.
Well, it's great to connect with the good self there. As I say, a very busy time of the year, this, of course, because it's the awards season. And, of course, it's volume 39 of the L. Ron Hubbard Presents Writers of the Future package. So here we are, 21st century, over 100 years since Carol Čapek came up with Rossum's Universal Robots, a little less than a century from when Fritz Lang actually had Metropolis, and a good 210 years or so since Mary Shelley arguably kicked off the modern science fiction era in the first place with Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. That's not to mention the Voyage Fantastique or Scientifique of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and others. Is science fiction in a rude health
I'm
then?
Impressed just with that opening monologue there.
I'm a great aficionado of the genre, but is it in rude health, John? Is the creativity still as good as ever, or are we effectively in a slightly fallow period when it comes to quality writing?
Well, I'm definitely of the opinion that we have amazing creativity still occurring. We have the winners that we just had this year from Canada were brilliant storytellers, and what's amazing about what I see as the future science fiction and a bit of a resurgence on short fiction is that we had, I think it was over 4 million books in journal published last year in 2022. And it's amazing. Just there's a lot of schlock, you know, I guess we use that term there, you know, a lot of really, really poorly written works, but this contest now, having been in existence for 40 years and we have some people who have been entering the contest for 10, 15, 20 years. Each time they submit, their quality of their storytelling gets up and up and up. And one of the things that I think is helping to substantiate my response to you is that we've got thousands of entries every quarter. And the contest break is broken into four quarters. So we have thousands of entries from over 135 countries. And so we have people that have been entering and just in the whole thing of how you improve as a storyteller is you write, you know, you keep on writing and they're encouraged to do such. And so we have a nurturing of storytelling of all forms. So it's not just, you know, you mentioned those story types there, which at the time they were brand new. There was new concepts, new ideas that were being created. What we have right now in these types of stories, and the fact that each of our books every year wins best science fiction, best fantasy novel of the year from either of two or three different independent publisher awards. So I like to think that we're finding, because of the nature of this contest, it's judged blindly. So everybody's got an equal chance. And you've got people that are sincerely trying to make that break into the industry. So they're giving their best foot forward each time they submit. So we're just finding some amazingly great stories that are being told, but of all types. You know, when you read a Writers of the Future book, it's not like this is science fiction about astronauts or this is fantasy about unicorns. It's just in general, science fiction, fantasy, dark fantasy. It's the whole spectrum of speculative fiction. And so we can guarantee there's something good for everybody. So I'm very much the optimist of this contest, and with the, you know, Orson Scott Card, one of the judges, he says, look, you know, this is one of the best ways to get yourself known. Dean Leslie Smith, you've got your Dean of Canadian Science Fiction, Robert J. Sawyer, who's an avid fan. He submitted many times before he proed out of this contest. So I'm pretty hopeful about that. We're doing something good for the genre.
I also omitted Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert there, who have got some pretty interesting credits to their line as well. You mentioned, John,
and Brian's father, Frank Herbert, was one of the original judges, as was Anne McCaffrey, before they passed.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned, of course, Anne McCaffrey, because that's my next topic, a debate that I think is always going to be ongoing, even with the McCaffrey legacy and the Dragon Riders of Pern, is, of course, is that science fiction? Is that science fantasy? Now, Anne's line was obviously, but the dragons were genetically modified. Clearly, it's science fiction. I'm not quite so sure.
I lost many conversations with her. She was a dear friend, and you know, she argued the point just voraciously, you know, that no, it is science fiction. She had scientists show what she did there. She had astronomers chart her star system. You know, this is where it was. She was adamant that she wrote science fiction.
I mean, I would still say that The Ship Who Sang, yes, that is science fiction. The Dragon Rider series, I'm less convinced. I'm still maintained that. But anyway, if she's looking down, I'm sure that's another topic for another time. In terms of the, let's give the winners the two sort of credits that they actually deserve, because obviously we have Spencer Sekulin, who's actually a paramedic and studying medicine. So again, a well-worn trait there. You could always say that the medical collection was coined by Michael Crichton, of course, who managed to actually parlay a lot of his experiences in medicine to things like Jurassic Park, Westworld, and so on. And then we have J.R. Johnson, who finds speculative fiction appealing because she likes the idea that there is more to the world than meets the eye. And I suppose this is leading to my next question, basically, John, that we almost are living in a science fiction world now. I mean, it's a debate I've had many times with my students over the years in terms of science fiction as an umbrella genre, a genre which can encompass the romantic comedy, the detective fiction, the Western, the Wild West, and so on, and effectively keep step with all of those. But with the exception of a few notable absences, Bastard Light, Travel being one, and presumably Instant Matter, Transmission being the other, we do seem to be living, the very nature of this interview tends to be tying into a science fiction world.
It does, except I was promised when I met George Jetson so many years ago that I'd be in my flying car, which I still don't have yet. But no, that's a fact, though. Other than that, but even there, we're close to having that flying car. Yeah, the whole idea of having, you know, this device, you know, that you could then, that was envisioned on Star Trek. But even like what you see right now, it was just unreal. I mean, when I grew up, you went out and you played. And then when it was dark, if you're not back by dinner time, you know, then you're go without, you know, and just now every kid goes out. And if a kid doesn't have a their own cell phone, then they're underprivileged. You know, the idea of, you know, like, you have one phone in your home and that you waited your turn to be able to get access to use it, you know, and you could give somebody now one of those phones and say, okay, so call this number, and they would have no idea what to do, you know? So things have changed so much. So yeah, we really are in that future, and it's really good, but it's getting, for me, it's a bit, since I can't really see, you know, totally, I've read too much science fiction to have a real positive outlook on the future with the AI taking over right now, more and more things, you know, like, are we really in control of this, or is it going to zoom out of control with the speed that it's going? Like, we're containing, like on this contest, we're containing it right now that you can't submit AI stories. And it's still easy for our judges, because they're so well-read and so themselves so prolific, they can tell an AI story. And for the AI art, if nothing else, we can just ask for the files that the artist used to create it, to see if there are layered files. And if not, then you know it's AI. And if they got layered files, then we're good. But when I take a look at what's happening right now on, you know, on social media and the stress and duress that's being on the kids, the lawsuit that just got filed against Meta, you know, because of what's happening to the kids, how it's profiling them and giving them stuff. And they're, what, a third of the kids right now have been working out suicide plans. Yeah, it's just, it's very, very scary. That coupled with the recent pandemic, that people stopped talking to each other. They started doing this. Everything was online. And, you know, so I'm uncertain about that. We are living that future. And some of that science fiction has been dystopian. Mm. You know, even though I'm very much the optimist, I'm also, I'm just now downloaded before starting here, the Rob Sawyer's latest book, you know, downloaded. And I'm listening like, wow. I mean, he's really into that technology side of life. And it, like, it just broke today. It just was offered today, the audiobook from Audible. And I'm about a half hour into it. And I realized, oh, it's almost 6:30, quick, you know, pause it.
See, if you had an AI assistant, then you wouldn't have had to worry about that, because the AI would have actually taken over and said it's time to actually do the media commitments and then return afterwards from that point of view. We do have this notion as well that, and in fact, funnily enough, the interview we're doing immediately after this, we're featuring an AI specialist from the Institute of Engineering about how AI is impacting the world and the globe and so on. Mm-hmm. And we know that's the case. We also know that we are currently, I think, in version 4 of ChatGPT, and the IQ of the AI is around about 150, which is about Einstein level. We're looking to increase that up to version 5 and then version 6 in 2024. There is this sense that actually science fiction, which used to be very much a prophylactic against future shock, that role, I mean, there's always a sense of, well, on the one hand, yeah, we embrace the technology, we embrace the changes. Mm-hmm. We haven't got the silver suits, or as you said, the hover cars as yet, although I'm sure Elon Musk is working on both. And again, the sort of the evil genius of X and the line that we have within that area. Oft times I feel that we also at the same time have to come to terms with the digital divide, that actually there are many folk for whom, either through cost of living crises or other issues, don't have the luxury of being able to do a broadband call, et cetera. Or indeed, in many cases, with respect to possibly age, if they haven't had a desire, might find it very, very scary. I mean, the very notion of multi-factor authentication is a whole new world.
Yeah. Oh, that is absolutely. I have so many, because I do so much different media, I've got all these different accounts. I have so many different passwords, so many, okay, you have to do this and then this and then this. And then now, because of what's happening, I get so many alerts that, okay, you've been hacked, you've been this, which is all fake, you know, and it's just what's real, what's imagined. And that's what I'm having to like grapple with. How do I prepare? Because I'm very visible. I'm very out there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm working out because right now I've got this, you know, here's an image of me. I'm talking here. If that got captured and then someone wanted to do the deep fake thing, which a lot of science fiction, near future science fiction goes in, that's exactly how, you know, things are going there. Like, what am I going to do with my wife and certain people where I have a certain phrase that I agree with them, that this is what we do on a phone call, something like that, to make sure that really is me or it really is them, because it can actually do that. It can fake it.
I was discussing issues with a colleague who was ex-RAF recently, and his line was that with drone technology improving on a day-by-day basis, we're now in a scenario where actually bombs are becoming smaller and smaller, surgical strikes are becoming much more precise. I'm not sure whether that applies to Gaza or Israel at present, but that's a whole other issue, or indeed mm-hmm. Ukraine. But in terms of that, another aspect, of course, of AI is that it controls humanity for our own good, which on the one hand you would say, yeah, okay. I mean, it's rather like, I can't recall the name of the text, but the question when AI computers, it certainly was echoed in the Colossus project, the Forbin project, and the Colossus multi-computer range of the 1960s. where effectively the final sequence of the text is where the question is put to the artificial intelligence, is there a God? And the response is, there is now. And ultimately, you have that sense of apprehension, sense of concern, sense of, in a sense, lack of freedom that actually is there. And the students that I take, obviously, yes, they will be enthused by the material, but there's an awful lot of frustrations there as well. I mean, for a long time, convergence seemed to be something, and the notion of all media coming together and the ultimate sort of end point that we were heading towards, the singularity, was very much that kind of perception that, yeah, fine, it's 4, 5, 6, 7 years away. Here we are in the third decade of the 21st century. And it seems as though actually with them, and again, that's what I'm thinking. Do you often find with writers of the future that in many ways, science fiction always reflects the era that it's being developed in? You know, we go back to Shelley, and it's the time within that we know. You talked about Frank Herbert and Anne McCaffrey, clearly writing in the countercultural world of the 60s. Frank Herbert dedicates Dune to the planetary ecologists, the real world planetary ecologists. Right. Philip K. Dick also had his own particular take on the experience of being human and so on. And Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler, you know, the list is endless in terms of writers being reflective of their own, even Robert Heinlein, actually. Although, again, he's had his critics over the years for a variety of reasons. But again, he's echoing both the hyper-masculine world of the 1950s with the sort of more laissez-faire permissive era of the 1960s and 70s and so on. So did you get a sense that as far as possible, and given that we're presuming none of the winners or neither of the winners are actually time travelers, could be, I mean, it could be happening, that actually there is a reflection of at least Western culture in the 21st century in the text that they were producing?
There is that, but it's not even just Western culture, because we've had one of our now judges, Nnedi Okorafor, we've got African culture. So we've had, you know, so we've had winners from 50 countries. So we have a lot of different science fiction that embraces all aspects of society and civilizations. But when Owen Hubbard created the contest, it was the year following his release of a book called Battlefield Earth. And very, very popular. It was, you know, several weeks on New York Times bestseller. It sold over 4.5 million copies.
It featured John Travolta in an interesting movie adaptation.
Indeed, it did. Unfortunately, there was sufficient deviation from the book that it didn't do it well. Yeah. But anyway, we'll keep it on to a book interview here. So although I did have a couple of interviews with Roger Christian, who's the director of that movie, as well as won the Oscar for the first Star Wars. And we talked about both movies on my podcast. But when Owen Hubbard wrote Battlefield Earth, he had in his intro that science fiction is the herald of possibility. So for him, he ultimately sees that it's the human spirit will overcome all opposition, all obstacles, and will survive. And so we see that coming out in the Writers of the Future series. You know, each year when we have stuff, there's like steampunk you read about steampunk 6 to 10 years before it became a go-to genre on Writers of the Future. Tim Powers, one of our judges, is one of the creators of steampunk. So you'll see stuff coming out usually half a decade to a decade before it becomes the popular genre, because these are tomorrow's authors that we're discovering today. So, so you find like Robert Sawyer or Brandon Sanderson. He was honorable mention in the contest before he had his breakout, and is now a judge as well. We have the prediction of what's going to be with our writers right now, because they obviously the competition, what they had to go through to be able to be selected to be the actual final published authors in Writers of the Future has earned them quite that distinction. But they now are also the go-to authors from editors, you know, so we have several editors that come to our awards summary every year to be able to meet the authors there and introduce them to the world of publishing. Some go traditional, some want to stay independent, and some will just go, you know, self. But yeah, there's usually a half a decade to a decade lag between our authors and what's going to be the mainstream science fiction fantasy.
And in terms of that, because I mean, you mentioned there'd been entries from Africa. Of course, one of the biggest changes in the 21st century has been the huge shift that the Chinese government actually decided when they went from banning science fiction outright and effectively having a complete ban on it to then opening the notion that that the Imagineers, as they refer to it, Imagineering folk and the likes of Wandering Earth, of course, Cixin Xu, etc., very much looking to drive this forward. Are you finding that actually, as a driver for change, the notion of science fiction, and let's be honest, the majority of hot topics relating to gender orientation, gender realignment, the whole notion of the planet, the ecological notion of eco-catastrophes, the AI, as we've spoken about, these are all thought experiments which have been discussed, you know, many a time over the years, even going back to the pulp fiction writers of A.E. van Vogt and Isaac Asimov and so on. You had a lot of these things emerging. So is that a sense that in one way, this is a wave of, I mean, cosmologists would say there's no such thing as time, that effectively it's an illusion, that as we're having this conversation, we're also seeing the big bang of the universe, we're seeing its end, its demise, we're being born, we're living through the whole thing. It's the notion of linear time is an illusion. Well, I think that's probably too heavy even for this particular interview.
That's a bit much, at least for this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we step away from that. But does science fiction, to a certain extent, serve as a wonderful vehicle, a template? I mean, I use two very basic terms, basically, when I ask the question, what is science fiction? And we come up with the notion of it's an allegory and it's also a metaphor. And I know that Darko Suvin says, yes, it also has to some extent have a novum. It has to have something which is new, which is unique about it, that actually is the, whether it's the MacGuffin, whether it's the plot line, whether it's something that works through that. We've also had the notion that it needs to have a making strange, a Fremdungs effect, which I think Hubbard in particular was very apt in terms of that strange notion of that. Are those all areas which, a bit like a good souffle, you need to kind of stir into your mix to actually get the ideal thing? Or is it a case of, that might be, but if an AI is listening to that answer, they'll probably actually try to program it accordingly?
I think, see, one thing, I'm in a particular position because I mentioned this podcast that I have, and so I'm having to read almost a book a week. And so I'm all over the place on all types of science fiction and fantasy. And by the way, Brandon Sanderson considers science fiction a subgenre of fantasy. You know, it's just, you know, which is definitely not my concept, but anyway, that's his concept. And he's, you know, he's right now becoming more and more the big gorilla in the game right now. But again, it's more of a simplistic, maybe it's being viewed as too simplistic, but it makes it easy for me to work with, is like you've got, you know, these, it's almost like a science fiction, the established writers of science fiction and fantasy are more like philosophers. And so if you look at it from that perspective as philosophers, they come out with these different ideas and directions and things that we can anticipate. And
clearly, on that basis, Plato was the first science fiction writer. Plato's cave is pure SF.
Exactly. And so there you take now a scientist, and it's then they wake up and they're like, okay, now how can I make that happen? And so that becomes like, as a philosopher, they then put there in that notion that someone who's the scientist, a technician type person, will go like, how can I make that happen? And I know that at least to a good degree, it pans out, because with Rise of Future, I've had as guest speakers at our awards ceremonies, I've had literally rocket scientists, those that have built and created the vehicles on Mars right now. They've talked about how when they first started, You know, as a little child, they were reading their science fiction. They wanted to do that. The astronauts we've had speak, they wanted to.
Arguably, no science fiction, no Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, no Wernher von Braun, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. You know, we had, I've had so many conversations with them saying, yeah, it was science fiction inspired them, made them wonder, how can I do this and how can I make that happen? I spoke with Elon Musk a few years ago at the premiere of one of the Star Wars movies in Hollywood. And, you know, he had read Battlefield Earth, but he read a lot of other books that he said he just loved. And those were his inspiration, you know, to move on with what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And so he got these ideas and he was working. Okay, how can I make that back?
I suspect he has been highly influenced by Kim Stanley Robinson's terraforming when it comes to his Martian explorations.
Yeah. He didn't get into saying that, but it was just, he was definitely inspired by science fiction, as are many other of our.
And indeed, as I said myself, the reason for doing a first degree in the sciences in chemistry and biology was because of the influence of Gene Roddenberry and Gerry Anderson in particular, who were producing obviously television-based science fiction, but again, looking at a way of, in the words of Isaac Asimov, when the laws were broken, they were broken in a way which at least didn't insult the viewer or the reader or the consumer, and actually addressed these issues as in a manner which could be deemed to be conceivably viable. I want to move, change tack slightly now, John, and I want to move to a kind of a slightly offbeat question, which is the notion of how we consume our science fiction. Because you mentioned earlier that you had downloaded Robert Sawyer's latest book and audiobook and listening to that and so on. And I often am quite surprised in terms of students in particular who still prefer the physicality of a paperback book, a novel that's actually there, as opposed to devices on Kindle and so on. And I'm just intrigued in terms of, you know, given that presumably back in the day where, you know, one of the most exciting parts of a bookshop or a drugstore or a place was its science fiction routine, where you had a collection of lurid covers and all manner of things. And then Battlefield Earth has obviously benefited in many ways from this side of things, and a lot of the Hubbard output as well. Do you kind of moan the fact that obviously the notion of the digital world, it's great portability, but do you feel that tactile sensation of, you know, the dog-eared cover of Foundation or iRobot or Starship Troopers or Stranger in a Strange Land and so on, you know, that actually is something that you kind of almost miss from a nostalgic point of view? Or would you say, no, that we're well out of that?
No, we're absolutely not. In fact, we're getting back into that even more so right now. I'm in London right now, and I just returned from Frankfurt Book Fair, where I just finished attending last weekend before I go home to Los Angeles. And it's interesting, especially in the Gen Z millennial, you know, that younger audience there, they're preferring reading the hard print books now because they spend all their day looking at a screen, and they don't want to enjoy a book on a screen. I'm listening to the audiobook on Rob Sawyer because the only way it's available right now, it just got released. It was a special from Audible where they have a 6-month exclusive on his book. They recorded it. It releases next April as a book, but I'll probably have him on as a guest again. I want to get through this book,
He's a good soloist, Robert. He's a big fan of Fireball XL5. So you should drop in the notion of on our way home on a regular basis. He'd like that.
Okay, good. I will. So I normally don't like, I enjoy audiobooks, but I can't really get into them a whole lot because I read so much faster than listening. And if I have to get through a book in a week, I don't have those hours to get through an audiobook. And I do prefer a print book, holding it there. And what I'll actually do when I'm trying to make a deadline before my next interview, I'll have the print book, because I usually get sent the books from whoever I'm interviewing, and they'll send me a link also. So when I'm walking somewhere, or, you know, I'll read a page here, reach page there, and then I'll go back to the book at my desk. And then, you know, so I'll move through myself through a book that way, you know, to get through it as quickly as possible. But I do enjoy reading the book. It's just, it's easier on my eyes, you know, to read a book. But the convenience of, you know, being able to go to my phone, you know, and just like in between stuff when I'm in a car going out. Okay, I can read a couple pages there. So for me, it's also business as well as pleasure. But if I have the opportunity, you know, I like just holding the book and reading it, whether it's hardcover or paperback. I do enjoy that. But it's interesting. I just, on a survey that we did in Frankfurt, like I said, this last weekend, and at some panels I went to, it's the young ones are going now back to print, and they're seeing an increase in sales of the print books because they're burned out just being on the screen so many hours. They want to be able to change the pace.
Initially, I must admit, I thought it was rather analogous to the blip of the popularity of LPs and the fact that, you know, we thought that vinyl was dead and that you never actually have those crackly moments. But that, again, seems to have undergone a bit of a resurgence because of its more human sound, perhaps, as opposed to the digital download. And, of course, the lack of album cover art and all of the concomitant things that, where you actually download a track, you might get some art that's actually there, but it's rare and it's few and far between. Most it's a case of the music itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, but like in Writers of the Future, the book itself, we've got, because it's a writer contest and an art contest, and we have the art from the winning illustrators of each of the stories in there, and it's beautiful. We have four color plates up in front of the book with all that art of the illustrations of the winning stories. You can't get that. You can't. Yeah, you have it in there, but when you see it in real life, you know, it's like, it's such a difference. It's so much more impressive.
Let's talk awards as we begin to conclude this particular side of things. And inevitably, we have the connection when people talk about, well, the Academy Awards of science fiction, and Victor Hugo's name is mentioned, obviously, in reference to the Hugo Awards. I've known a few Hugo Award winners, of course, Robert Sawyer being one of them, I believe.
Hugo Gernsback.
Yep. Thank you. There we are. You see, a deliberate mistake thrown in, proving that I'm not artificial intelligence, you see. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have had that. Okay, so good. There you go.
So there you go. You've handled it now. I know you're the real thing now.
It's the test. It's like ticking the boxes in terms of how many cars you see, how many bicycles you see. Do you actually confuse Victor Hugo with Hugo Gernsback? That's fine. So in terms of Hugo Gernsback, who, of course, started off his whole career very much as an engineer, as a technician, who was basically sort of producing things. And the fantasy of science kind of emerged almost as a byproduct of that. But nevertheless, the fact the name for the Hugo Awards was actually there. Do you think that, in a sense, the L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future Awards, of course, now in their 39th year, are they complementary? Are they to be competitive? Is it a case of, it's a bit like the Emmys and the Golden Globes and the Academy Awards, etc.? It's a case of, look, getting one of these awards is significant no matter where it's actually coming from.
That's a fact on that. And I've had many, many reviews from Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Booklist, and a lot of the major authors too that have since become judges. And the significance of Writers of the Future is that it's not a popularity contest, which some of the contests are. It's not a contest for established writers. It's a platform for someone new wanting to get in. And so for that reason, there's nothing that competes against. Mm. And so many times been referred to as one of the top three awards. You got Hugo and the Nebulas and the Hubbard Awards. What makes this special and unique, and why you have like the Robert Sawyers of the world that so thoroughly support it, is because the integrity of the contest is free to enter. It's open to anybody who's not professionally published. And all the judges ever see is a number assigned to the story. So they have no idea if it's male, female, nationality, ethnic, sex, anything, just anything. It's strictly on the merit of the story. And so Rob Sawyer says it's a true meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very unique. And then,
Certainly, given the controversy that was present at the Hugo Awards a few years ago, I think that's essential in terms of how things are being presented and so on.
Yeah, and so it's when that whole thing blew up, we had a lot more people show their support for Writers of the Future at that time, And I mean, I'll stay clear from it because we have everybody listening to this podcast.
Indeed, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So it's perfectly fine. John, it's been awesome connecting with your good self today. I have to say, I tend not to use the mobile phone, but I do tend to use one of these devices, the tablet.
I find them very, very useful.
Exactly. So that's my sort of pedigree. I also think for the benefit of the listener, you probably see this if you look at our Facebook page. It does look as though I'm outside. And John's very much inside in terms of obviously his location from the whole side of things there. But actually, we're probably both inside. But there you go. Just goes to show the craziness of life.
Yes.
Got two final questions to put to you, though. There are actually three. First of all, how can people actually follow your good self and indeed the Writers of the Future contest online? What's the best place you'd actually point them?
Sure. Well, there's writersofthefuture.com. And on there, we've got enter the writer contest, enter the illustrator contest. We have a free online workshop that consists of about a dozen videos that we recorded with Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game, Tim Powers, that wrote On Stranger Tides, which was made into the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and Dave Wolverton, who was our coordinating judge until he passed a year and a half ago, and then about 10 essays that are used in the annual writer's workshop. So that's a free course. I have the podcast on there, which is now 240 episodes or so in there. We have a forum, a writer's forum, which you can join. It's won the best writer's forum for the last 3 years from various science fiction contests. And so you can, all that stuff is right there for you to be able to find out. On social media, it's WOTF contest for Writers of the Future. So WOTF contest, we've got Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. And for myself, I'm John Goodwin, ASI. ASI stands for Author Services, Inc., which is a literary agency for L. Ron Hubbard. But that's my personal Facebook page. And so you can also find the books that we're talking about here. Any bookstore in Canada, any bookstore in the United States, Amazon, Kobo, or just...
And willing to connect, obviously, with Britain, Europe, and the rest of the globe. So there's two final questions that we've come to now. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this feature? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, I'm really much enjoying it. I'm relieved to know that you're not AI with the way that you were rattling off everything. Your knowledge was like, I was so impressed. I was just like, wow. He is really knowledgeable.
Maybe it's because I don't have a social life, John. I don't know. It's just one of those things, one of those areas. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again from California or another part of the world? Will you be kind enough to come back?
I would love to. And as I do more talk with you, I'd love to have you as a guest on my podcast too. It's been very, very successful. And I love... Because the whole purpose of that is to provide inspiration and tips for writers and artists. And you definitely, I'm sure, have many things that you could offer on the history of science fiction and possibly.
Well, hopefully some of my students have gone on to some reasonable routines. It's a case of we pass them through. Pass it forward. That's the key thing. Pay it forward.
Pay it forward for sure.
John Goodwin, huge thanks. Take care and keep reading those novels.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Artificial intelligence, it's something that probably has been one of the most popular terms that's emerged over the last year or so, although those of us who've kind of been involved with respect to science and science fiction can go way, way, way back to Isaac Asimov and his laws of robotics and various other sort of areas within that. But how do we relate to it on a day-to-day basis? Well, to actually talk about that and indeed maybe some of the future aspects about technology and the connections with that, we're delighted to welcome from the Institute of Engineering and Technology, Dr. Junaid Ali. How are you, Junaid?
Hello, good morning.
Excellent. Well, it's great to connect with your good self, but are you worried about AI? Is it a case of we need to start every interview that we're doing now by saying neither Junaid nor myself are indeed artificial intelligence? We are carbon-based life forms with our own organic life?
Well, I think like many technologies, I think it's a matter of understanding the risks, but also being able to seize the opportunities that are there. So I think it's a matter of, going into the future with our eyes wide open. And I think this new research from the IET really highlights that with, demonstrating that 51% of people feel nervous about the future of AI, but at the same time, people recognizing the opportunities around manufacturing, healthcare, and climate change as well.
Yeah, we use AI in our daily lives almost three times more than we think we do. I mean, is that because it's become, like most kind of technologies, invisible to our general senses, and we just kind of accept it being there just as a matter of course?
Absolutely. In fact, in my own career, you know, the first time I actually encountered work on AI systems was when, you know, if any of your listeners are driving right now, when they're driving along the road, the sensors in the road, which will tell, detect car accidents, or when they will detect things like, traffic data for people's GPSs. There's AI used in that. And then when people are calculating routes on their GPSs, there's AI used in that. And then take it a bit more, closer to people, when people are using search engines, grammar checkers, recommendations for what they're going to watch on a streaming platform, there's AI there as well. So it's very much invisible. I mean, computers themselves has become invisible, and so has AI over recent years as well.
As one might expect, the Institute of Engineering and Technology presumably will be at the forefront of issues relating to this. But do you find that members even there tend to get a little bit cautious when it comes to, well, what safeguards and checks are in place when it comes to artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so I think this has definitely been an important topic. And I think this is where work that the IET is doing is really important around things like helping policymakers being able to come up with regulation and guidance for the future, and being able to make sure that society is able to seize the benefits. So I think one of the things which will be really beneficial going forward is seeing policymakers working together with engineers in order to make sure that these risks are addressed, but we're also able to seize the opportunities and make sure this is beneficial to society as a whole.
November is, of course, the month of the Holy Souls, and you might say that AI can actually grant immortality, and ultimately we will simply just upload our intelligences into a whole new cloud form. But it's also actually the start of November, at least the 1st or the 2nd of November, the AI Safety Summit, in which global leaders will be gathering to discuss the risks associated with AI. What would you like to see come out of that, Junaid?
Yeah, so definitely I'd like to see greater engagement with the engineering community in working together and addressing a lot of this. I mean, from the research the IET has done, I think we've seen that, 36% of people feel that the government needs to introduce more regulation as it develops. So that's something which I'm particularly keen to see. That greater collaboration is, I think, something which is going to be really important to make sure that government and regulators around the world don't miss a boat on this.
I was having a chat recently with somebody who was formerly of the RAF, and he was commenting on how AI has kind of been percolated through in terms of drone usage and other aspects of defence and so on. I mean, is that something we should be afraid of? I mean, this notion that actually, just like driverless cars, driverless vehicles, the other aspects you've given, there are obviously several nightmare scenarios that sometimes certainly speculative fiction writers love to actually focus their texts on.
I mean, definitely in terms of, there's a whole area around what we do with AI safety going forward. And I think that's going to be a very real concern, especially, as you mentioned, with things like military systems. I think one of the key reasons we haven't seen necessarily those examples come out yet is because the AI and the cost of computation itself is still expensive. So that's been almost a limiting factor, but we can expect that, I think, to go quite soon. And as that happens, those types of circumstances can become a little bit more realistic, because AI will be able to do considerably more, and it will be able to and people will be able to train bigger and bigger models. So I think that's something we definitely need to be cautious of going forward, as the power behind our computer chips just expands more and more.
You're a cybersecurity and AI expert, Junaid. I mean, talking about cybersecurity, I mean, one of the things I've certainly noticed over the last few years is with multi-factor authentication,
and obviously biometrics and other areas, it seems to be getting more and more complex simply to actually log in and actually identify to various other areas of one's life. Do you feel that there's any danger that a digital divide could be emerging? And, you know, there are people who, frankly, for understandable reasons, will just say, I just don't know where to start. You know, it used to be so simple where we just used to have one password or one particular aspect to access it, as opposed to having to deal with all these rogue cyber criminals and so on.
It's actually interesting, Lisa. One of the things, one of the things I worked on during my career is when sometimes users when they're using an iPhone or, you know, the Google Chrome browser, when they're logging into a site, they'll see a breached password notification saying your password's been in a data breach. And I actually did a lot of work across the industry to try and move away from using these very complex password composition rules to using, you know, more simple rules where people are notified when a password is in a breach, and so it materially impacts security, but also hopefully does usability. I think people in that boat, I think there are a few general guidelines I'd just recommend to your listeners. If they're in that position, that's, you know, ideally use a password manager. There are lots of people who still have these, you know, complex password management rules. You know, use multi-factor authentication where possible, and you know, if you get notified your password's in a data breach, change it as soon as you find out. So that's basically, I think, if you follow those kind of guidelines, it can very much kind of simplify your digital life when it comes to managing authentication.
And talking about simplification, do you think we can ever get to the stage where AI can simply be designated, or you can delegate that responsibility to AI and we don't have to worry about such things?
I think, you know, it's one of those areas where AI can improve operational efficiency. I know there's some people in the community at the moment who are doing some research into this, but I think definitely in terms of security, this is one of those areas where, you know, technology will play an important role in terms of being able to differentiate between human actors and machine actors. And that's something where, you know, it's really important for policymakers and engineers to be able to work together, because that's something which will be really critical going forward. And, you know, that's something which is, you know, one of those quite meaty technical domains that you go back years, you hear about the Turing test and things like that. And I think that's one of those areas where it's important to get things right.
The days when we actually have to tick in the box which has a traffic light system or a car or a bicycle in there, could they be approaching their end?
Well, you know, those are very much used to train, you know, self-driving cars at the end of the day. But I think, you know, we do see results from these recent large language models being able to do that. I mean, one of the things I'm particularly excited for on that front going forward is, in fact, there is inside many computers, many phones, there's actually chips which can be used for someone to be able to prove personhood. So that's one of the potential routes that can be used to kind of get away from this technology, you know, the need for people to do that going forward. As the cost of AI comes down, it will, of course, become a lot more cost effective for people to be able to automate that process. Though, ironically enough, if you around the world, you do actually get many people who will outsource, you know, capture completions. I think there was an example of this where someone asked an AI to complete a capture, so complete one of these challenges, and it actually went ahead and it went to an outsourcing website and paid someone, and it even came up with a reason saying, you know, I'm visually impaired, please solve this capture for me.
Yeah, very tricky, this AI algorithm that sometimes emerges in terms of our life scenarios. Junaid, where can people find out further information about the sort of things we've been talking about today, and indeed the Institute of Engineering and Technology?
Yep, absolutely. So if anyone's more interested in this, I'd definitely recommend visiting the IET's website, IET.org, where you can learn more about the institution, and you can keep abreast of some of the work that's coming around AI.
Junaid Ali, IET Fellow and Cybersecurity and AI Expert. Huge thanks, and keep on having faith in the future, Junaid.
Thank you. Great to chat.
Advanced cooking technology, does it actually work? Of course it does. Does it make us healthier? Does it make us more adventurous in the kitchen? Well, hopefully we'll find out in the next few moments, because we've got TV chef extraordinaire to share some thoughts with us, and that's the wonderful Clodagh McKenna. How are you, Clodagh?
I'm really good, Alex. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to be with you and to have you featured on this thing, because I was fascinated to see that the air fryer, which has come under a lot of flack recently, I think people say, not another air fryer, but it's top of the list for most wanted kitchen gadgets. I mean, were you surprised by this QVC study that says it's all about the air fryer?
I mean, it is. I mean, it's not just QVC that are saying this. Us as chefs are saying it too. It has taken the nation like nothing else in the kind of cooking utensil equipment world as long as I can remember. I mean, nearly half of all of Brits now have an air fryer, and there is a reason for this phenomenon. So kind of, when you said at the beginning that there was a little bit of criticism, none of the criticism has happened because of the actual machine itself. The machine itself has only gotten great reviews. It is amazing. It you know, and I don't talk this about, you know, kitchen equipment or kitchen utensils lightly, because, you know, my reputation is really important to me. It's all I have. And so this is probably one of the first pieces of big kitchen equipment that I've gone on chatting about, you know, publicly. It completely transforms your way of thinking. And there are so many reasons why it is this big phenomenon. And, you know, it is a huge phenomenon. So there has to be lots of reasons for it, because, you know, not everybody is looking for the same thing out of, you know, a cooker. I will start with the healthy side of things, because, you know, it's important and we all love to eat and it's lovely to be healthy. And especially with, you know, mental health awareness being so important right now, you know, eating healthy affects your mental health. It's been completely proven both scientifically and in all other different studies. And when you use an air fryer, you use less fat. I mean, it's just like that. So if you like any fried food, which we all do, I mean, I'm not sure I've ever met anybody who doesn't like a little piece of fried food, whether it's fried chicken or badgies, which I made last night, or fries or anything that you want crisp, or you would put into a deep fat fryer, you can do it in the air fryer with either no oil or even just a tiny teaspoon of it. So you are cutting down on your added fats immediately, so you can still enjoy it. The great thing that I'm getting so excited about is that you can still go on and enjoy it. Like, for example, yesterday I made the most delicious butternut squash and carrot badgies. Alex, you have to promise me you're going to make them. And when I was making up the mixture was so moist, and I thought, and I love badgies so much, I love making them. They are tricky to make, that's for sure. Because you've got to get, you know, if you're doing them in a frying pan, you've got to get them in the oil. The oil has to be the perfect temperature, and you've got to turn them and stand over it, and the oil splashes everywhere and all the rest. But so I was really curious about how it would work in the air fryer. So I'm back to the mixture. I had the mixture, the bowl. I popped them into the drawer of the air fryer. And people who know and use air fryers, which is probably a lot of your listeners, know that you don't turn on the air fryer until you put it in. Again, saving in so much energy costs. You're saving about 15 minutes of energy costs. So I put them into the drawer, and the kind of the sloppy kind of liquid was there, or a mixture was on the drawer. And I thought, how is that going to crisp up? And I popped it in, turned it on air fryer mode. And when I pulled open the drawer to turn them over, I could not believe, I swear to God, I yelped, Alex. I could not believe how crisp they were when I turned them over, and still lovely and moist in the inside. So it was amazing. And there wasn't a drop of my mixture, my badgie mixture, left on the drawer. It had completely done it so fast. And also, that's the great thing about it, it cooks faster than conventional ovens. So again, you're saving on your energy time. Also, if you're hungry and you want things fast, you get it done. But I, you know, the big thing about this is that it makes it so easy. It makes cooking so easy. It takes out all of, you know, the stress of cooking. You still get the enjoyment part of cooking, which is, you know, getting your ingredients out and the little prep and all the rest. but the kind of, you know, hanging over and being chained, you know, to the oven and all the rest, that is all gone. That's a thing of the past with the Ninja air fryer.
Loda, I mean, the passion that you've just shared with us is phenomenal. I'm almost tempted to actually say, this is not just any food, it's a Loda McKenna air fryer food. I mean, it's just just as a strap line, it's phenomenal. I mean, just looking at some of the finds here, you might have even persuaded me to actually go beyond my normal very limited range in terms of the cookery side of things to say, I might even invest myself in one of these, which is a huge step in all sorts of areas. You talked about eating healthily, of course. We do try to avoid ultra-processed food. We all are concerned about nutrition, I think, from that point of view. And this would seem to be a wonderful, relatively straightforward solution to actually ensure that, you know, as you say, I mean, you've been raving about this. Is it any wonder that that almost half of people want an air fryer want an air fryer even more? So, I mean, presumably, are there any setbacks, Clodagh, in terms of the air fryer? Is it a case of no? From my perspective, basically, it's all good.
You know, it really is all good. And it feels kind of odd to be saying that because, you know, there always should be something that doesn't work. And it does, you know, everything works in it. You can even bake in it. So yesterday I made flatbreads in it and they were beautiful and fluffy and they browned perfectly. You know, you can do cookies in them. You can do cakes in them. You can do so much in it. And the great thing about it as well is that it's like movable. It's a movable feast, you know, so there's no plumbing involved or anything like that. It's like you literally just plug it in like you would do an old microwave. You plug it in to any socket and so you can bring it anywhere you want. So if you're doing an Airbnb or anything like that, or if you're going over to your friend's house for Christmas, you can take it anywhere you want to. Or if you're moving around your kitchen, which I'm always doing, I'm always trying to do like a little refurb in my kitchen all the time. I mean, if you know anybody that's living on their own or somebody who is maybe a new mom or a new dad and they don't have much time and they need a helping hand, or they're elderly and they're living on their own, this is like a really wonderful kind of gift of life that you can give because it will transform, you know, your everyday life. You know, if you start cooking again, your life is transformed. And I mean, that's why I'm so passionate about food, because I know food is transforming. This just makes it so easy.
Clodagh, I mean, I'm almost tempted to actually award you the role of the official high priestess of the air fryer religion. I mean, the passion, the zeal that's coming through there, quite genuinely phenomenal. It's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. Will you be kind enough sometime to return and share more air fryer tips?
I would love to. And for those of you out there who are searching for tips, go on and just Google it, because there are so many recipes out there that me and other chefs are putting up. I put up amazing, you know, the badgies that I told you about. They're all up on my Instagram. Go over to Ninja Air Fryer Instagram as well. And then go up to QVCUK.com. They've got loads of cookery videos up there too. So even if you have one, you know, go up and have a look and start kind of like experimenting, you know, with different kind of foods that you can make in it.
Clodagh McKenna, TV chef extraordinaire, huge thanks. And may your air fryer always do justice to the quality of your loquaciousness.